Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I thought too.
Here's John Williams.
Moments ago, it's the bonus track. This is John. We're in the Skyline Studios, overlooking beautiful downtown, hot, muggy Chicago. Not many of these left, and those of us that like these are enjoying this, he said, from a beautiful air-conditioned studio. We're here today till 3, Saturdays 10 to noon. I don't know if you've got your tickets to Teddy Saves America yet. It's our new Teddy Roosevelt show. It's going to be October 12th. Did you get them yet? It's fast selling out. It's going to be at 10:30 in the morning at the Elgin Community College Blizzard Theater. Tickets at WGNradio.com/Teddy. WGNradio.com/Teddy to get tickets. In the 2:30 hour or segment, let's talk a little bit about the new Miss Monopoly game. Did you guys hear about this?
I saw a picture of the board, but I didn't look into the details.
I didn't either. I thought it's a new Miss Monopoly game or a Monopoly game. There's a bunch. There's a Chicago one. There's a this one. There's
oh, yeah,
a that
I collect
one.
Some of them. I don't have a big collection, but I have about maybe 12.
That qualifies as a big collection in
oh, really?
My world. I mean, that you're collecting them at all, but that's kind mm-hmm. of fun. The new
cool.
Miss Monopoly collection or version does this. It says, since women have historically been underpaid and have systematically had fewer opportunities than men, in the playing of the new Miss Monopoly game, the women start with $1,900 and the men start with $1,500 so as to settle the score.
Oh, interesting.
Interesting, yes. Leave it there. Wait till Bertrand chimes in on this, because I know how he's going to feel about it, and I kind of feel the same way, too. Okay, now chime in. I think that's...
I'm sorry, I just sat down. I didn't hear it.
What message is that sending? Steve, the new Miss Monopoly game gives the girls that play, the females that play, $1,900, and the men, the males that play, start with $1,500. So as to settle the score.
Well, how do I feel about that, John? I think that's too bad, actually. I could see it in some other venue to make a point, but not if you're giving it to young girls to play.
I'm just wondering what message that sends.
Right.
I mean, I think that's a very complicated little game they're playing there.
Well, in all fairness, they also came out with a version that encouraged cheating. So there
did
are
they
some.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. But if you got caught, there were these handcuffs, and you would get handcuffed to the board.
By the way, the version that encourages cheating is the one we grew up with. I mean, you know,
yeah,
how many of you were
that's
go,
true.
Mark, did you take money from the bank? Or wait a minute, I had more houses on that property. Come on.
In your life, how many Monopoly games have you completed?
Played from beginning to end?
Yeah.
Oh, well, if you say after the age of 16, I don't remember doing that. But from 6 to 16, wow, that was a staple in my life.
Well, I used to enjoy playing it, but I don't remember ever finishing a game. That's
they would
my
be
point.
Marathon things. You would sometimes play for 3-4 hours. You'd just sit there.
Yeah, I didn't.
On the living room rug of the Killian's house or the Pfeiffer's, or I'm thinking of some of the houses I probably played it at over the years. Our house, and that was fun. But nobody has time for a 4-hour game of Monopoly, let alone the analog version with actual die and little pieces. Kind of makes me want to play the game. We'll talk about this new version at 2:35. Mary Schmeek's in our studio at 2:05. Looking forward to that. And Phil Vitale has some interesting restaurants to review in a few minutes. Listen to this story. It's from The Atlantic. Joseph Lott, a sales representative for Compaq Computers, had a penchant for art ties, neckties featuring famous masterpieces. It began many years earlier, he said. I love impressionistic paintings, and I use them as a way to make points with my kids. I put on an art tie, and then I would ask my kids, I have 3 daughters, I would say, artist identification? And they would have to tell me whether it was a Van Gogh or a Monet, and we would have a little conversation about the artist. One morning, he put on a green shirt, before meeting colleagues at a Marriott hotel. It was in advance of speaking at a conference that day. And over breakfast, before he would give his speech, his co-worker, Elaine Greenberg, who had been on vacation the week before, presented him with a tie that she'd spotted on her trip. The tie featured a Monet. It was red and blue primarily, he says. I was very touched that she had done this. So I said, this is such a nice gesture. I'm going to put this on and wear it as I speak. And she said, well, not with that shirt. You're not going to put on a red and blue tie with a green shirt. So when breakfast was done, his colleagues went off to the conference meeting, and he went back to his hotel room to change shirts. He ironed a white one, put it on, and then headed back down toward the hotel lobby. He says, as I was waiting to go from the seventh floor back down to the lobby and over to the bank of the elevators that I would take up to the top where the meeting was, I felt a sudden movement in the building. The meeting, Graf writes, was at the World Trade Tower. Getting the new shirt had saved his life. The woman who gave him the tie was not so fortunate. It was in changing the shirts that he got out of that building, and while he was ironing it, the plane was on its way, and when he got back down to the bank of elevators, the plane was hit. The plane hit the building. He wasn't there. He survived, and the others did not. There's a new book, The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11, and it's written by this guy whose piece is excerpted in the latest edition of The Atlantic, theatlantic.com. Garrett Graff is a journalist and historian. And what he says is that on 9/11, luck meant everything. We like to think we're in control of our destiny. We like to think that if we make the correct decisions that we'll have successful or longer lives. But serendipity plays such a role and who we are, and the fact that we're even here. And that's such a good point. And to illustrate it, he talks to a lot of people who survived 9/11 by the most whimsical or unexpected of decisions. And then he just tells some stories that I thought I'd heard them all, but I hadn't heard any of these. Some of them, he says, are famous, and some of them are just private citizens who he sought out and he found their stories. And of course, the opposite is true too. It was equally tragic for the people who, when they should have turned left, turned right in the smoke, and they did not survive. The storytelling is really good. He'll join us after this. So that piece I read from The Atlantic is excerpted evidently from a book that's written by this guy named Garrett Graff. On 9/11, luck meant everything. The book is The Only Plane in the Sky. Garrett, welcome to the show. You're on WGN Radio. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for having me today.
It just dawns on me, maybe I didn't give the title of your book correctly. The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. That's your book, right?
Yes. Yep.
And is that just out now?
Just out yesterday, yep.
So what inspired this? You were on another interview and not listening to my show just moments ago, but I shared the first anecdote in the Atlantic piece about the guy with the necktie who survives because he went to get a different shirt and his colleague did not. What inspired this? Why did you decide to tell these stories this way?
Yeah, you know, my goal with this book, to tell 9/11 only through the voices of the people who lived it, was to try to capture the emotional experience of living that day. You know, we're at the 18th anniversary of 9/11 now. We're beginning to see this slip from memory to history, a generation of students now coming into the world who don't remember that day at all. And so when we say never forget, what we usually mean are the facts of the day, the four planes, nearly 3,000 Americans killed, Twin Towers, the Pentagon, Shanksville. And what we're losing is the memory of what that day was like to live as an American. And so this book follows 480 Americans coast to coast, morning to night, in their own words, from air traffic controllers to people at the Twin Towers in the Pentagon at Shanksville, as well as in the bunker with Vice President Cheney and aboard Air Force One with President Bush. And I think it's so important to remember those voices, to remember what that experience was like, to remember the chaos, the confusion, the fear, and the trauma that they experienced for us, because that was what drove the decisions that people made after 9/11. And we live in this world today, shaped our national politics, our international geopolitics, still very much shaped by 9/11. And yet we sort of forget why we did the things that we did in the wake of 9/11.
I think about that sometimes when I'm at the airport taking off my shoes. Were we taking off our shoes? Actually, I think the shoe bomber was it inspired that. But
yes,
the disrobing for the machines at the airport, I don't remember. We didn't do that before 9/11, right?
No, not at all. And remember, the 9/11 hijackers were able to bring knives and box cutters aboard the plane, which were the weapons that they used that day, because that was allowed under the security regulations. And one of the things that really does come through when you go back and you look at these human voices and look at that experience of that day is the incredible innocence of America on the morning of 9/11. You know, we hear people say now 9/11 changed everything, but we forget just how different things were before. And so, you know, we look back at that first attack, the first crash, and how most of America sort of looked at that with puzzlement. You know, we assumed it was an aviation accident, a pilot having a heart attack, air traffic control having problems. And that one of the things, one of the quotes in the book that I tell is a New York ferry captain who watches that first crash, comes into the Wall Street terminal with his load of morning commuters, and every single one of them gets off the boat and walks into Lower Manhattan, even as papers and envelopes are floating down from the impact of that first plane. There wasn't anyone who sort of looked at that and defaulted to terrorism. That was just not the way that America was thinking that first morning. And of course, now we see those, you know, that video from last month over the summer of a motorcycle backfiring in Times Square and everyone runs for their lives. And what we sort of forget that today we default to thinking it's terrorism. We default to thinking it's an attack or a shooting. Whereas on 9/11, it really wasn't until that second plane hit at 9:03 Eastern time that you began to sort of see people realize that the country was under attack.
I'll get your book. I don't have it today. Normally I've read the book before I put an author on the air, but I just saw this Atlantic piece yesterday and thought, oh, let's jump ahead. You mentioned in the article there's the incredible story of Ladder 6 led by Captain Jay Jonas. Can you tell me a little bit about that story?
Yeah, and this is another example of, you know, the tiny choices that people made that day that ended up saving or costing lives. And Ladder 6 is this incredible story where they actually stop to help save a woman, a civilian, as they are evacuating the Twin Towers. And that puts them, that choice to stop and save Josephine Harris ends up actually putting them in the one place where they are able to survive the collapse of the towers. And they are trapped for much of the afternoon and the hours after 9/11, but eventually rescued, and they all survive that day. And in one of sort of the poignant parts of the epilogue, it was actually years later when Josephine Harris died of natural causes. Ladder 6 showed up, and they were her pallbearers to help carry her into the next stage of her world.
I did not know that story. You mean these guys, maybe gals, were inside the building as it collapsed around them, and they survived?
They survived in the stairwell. They were trapped in one particular part of the stairwell, and actually were able to live.
Maybe that explains. I remember as we were all dissecting what happened in the weeks afterwards, and a colleague of mine at the radio station, there's nothing funny about this, but I remember him hearing the internet rumor about how some firefighters or a firefighter were up in the building and they rode the debris down, sort of slid with the building and survived, kind of gliding down the side as the building collapsed underneath them. And I said, that's impossible. And he said, no, I know, but it happened. A guy actually slid down. That didn't happen, but I guess this did. How hard was it to get people to tell their stories?
So the book is based, as I said, on 480 voices, a mix of original interviews that I did and then some incredible oral history work by institutions like the 9/11 Museum, the Pentagon Historian, the Flight 93 National Memorial, who understood the importance of trying to capture these stories in the initial years after 9/11. And one of the things that has stood out to me in my work and then from conversations with some of the oral historians who worked on these projects as well is just how generous so many people are in telling and sharing their stories for history that day, that they feel in some ways often that sharing their story for future generations is one of the most important things that they can do to help ensure that the world never forgets the trauma of that day.
But the article, too, in the Art magazine, and maybe this is reflected throughout the text, but it's the serendipity of it, right? There's really no rhyme or reason to who lives and who doesn't in a tragedy. If it was a mass shooting at a mall, a bullet hits you, it doesn't hit the next person. There's no sense to it, right?
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the things that comes across when you look at the depth of these stories. And the way that that day unfolded is that we tell ourselves a much cleaner and neater story 18 years later about what 9/11 was like. That, we know that the whole thing took place in 102 minutes from the first crash to the collapse of the second tower at 10:29 Eastern time that morning. We didn't know that on 9/11. And so to go back, the book really tells the confusion that unfurled as these attacks rippled across the country. Well into the afternoon, people feared other hijacked planes. The Sears Tower in Chicago was evacuated because they feared a plane would attack it. Disney was shut down that day because they feared an attack on Disney. And that this, that confusion and the challenges of that day really helped underscore and really helps to make sense of the decisions that our national leaders made in the wake of 9/11.
Do you have any thoughts about the Taliban being at Camp David this past weekend? I don't know if your writing or research reflects on that in any way.
Yeah, I think the thing that sort of really stood out to me about that is just how much the world that we are living in today is still shaped by 9/11. That this is, even 18 years on, we are still wrestling with the consequences of that day, even as you now have a new generation of American servicemen and women deploying to those war zones who were, as of this year, now born after the attacks themselves. America has never had a war that stretched so long that people who fought in it were not there at the start. Everyone in World War II remembers Pearl Harbor. They knew what they were fighting for. Everyone in the Civil War understood and remembered Fort Sumter. And the idea that we now have a generation of American servicemen and women taking to battlefields for a war that began literally before they were born, that should be a real moment of pause for us as a country.
Think about that. You might read the Atlantic piece on 9/11, Luck Meant Everything. It's in part based on the book, The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. Really interesting storytelling. I'm glad you took the time to do it. Thanks for joining us today, Garrett.
Thanks for having me today.
Garrett Graff. Whenever I go to Target or Home Depot, it seems to me the Jewel, there's usually handicapped spots available up front. Some people may abuse it, but if you are a person, boy, I'm going to get it now.
No, I'll take the heat off you. Go ahead with what I say next. Go ahead.
If you are if you're a person with a handicap tag, I'll bet you very, very, very rarely are denied a space up front. Steve Bertrand, go.
I think there are too many handicapped spots.
I love the colors yellow and green. I like talk radio when they talk about things. Let's talk about things.
You've been doing me that favor lately, Steve. I bring up an incendiary, controversial topic. I dip my toe in the water, and you're doing a cannonball in the middle.
I got your back. So But my point is, I think there should be just as many handicapped spots as we need. You know, so do studies and see how many it is that are being used. We need all those. But if we see that there are many, many that aren't being used, maybe we could reduce the number.
You know what I just heard you say?
What?
Too bad for the handicapped people.
That's not true.
That's what you just said on WGN.
That's not fair at all.
No, it's not. That's what I heard you say, though.
It's like the stuff you say about Phil Vitale after he leaves the studio.
Oh, come on. He's standing right here.
Oh, man. I was going to say something nice about your position on handicapped spaces, too.
You agree?
No. Actually, no. I make this. What?
Phil is the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune.
Okay, I should probably bring that up.
Hi, Phil.
Hi. I try to make this is what constitutes my exercise program. I try to park as far away as I comfortably can, preferably right next to one of those shopping cart carrels. Is that my level of laziness? if I get pole position, one of those spaces that might ordinarily be a handicapped parking space. Then I come back with my cart. Now, where do I put the cart? I have to bring it back to the store, or I have to go find a carrel, which is
right there,
actually farther away. So I go park right by the carrel, usually out there, and that's my exercise, walking the extra 100 feet to get into the store.
By the way, I want to thank you, John, for replaying it today, making my injury even worse.
I just thought it was amusing, and we like to, at 1:35 out of the news, just feature a fun segment from a previous broadcast. By the way, I suppose restaurants have to adhere to the same rules as stores. They have to have sufficient handicap parking, et cetera.
If they have parking at all, which is usually they have valet. And I don't know if you have a car that specifically will accommodate a wheelchair person using a wheelchair.
Yeah,
you're probably not going to let your valet touch it.
We were at where were we the other day? Zia's on Ashland, and the valet was free.
Wow.
I don't know how many people do that, but the guy then brought my car around afterwards, and I says, okay, what is the damage here? And he said, no, it's free. Well, then I gave him what I thought it was going to be anyway.
Sure.
I think it was $5, but now I felt really generous.
Exactly.
I'd already mentally parted with the money, but now I happened to give it to him, and it worked out well for everybody.
That's kind of a thing in the suburbs. Because restaurants often have their own parking lots or a nearby place they can do. So they have complimentary valet parking or valet parking for a nominal $3 or something like that. I think the valets actually do better that way.
What do you mean?
Than with the charge.
Oh, yeah, right. Complimentary, and then I'll just take the tip. I'll bet the kid's doing better.
Much better, because the charge is not going to the valet. It's going to whatever the valet company is paying that remote lot for access for that night.
By the way, speaking of busy restaurants, I ordered pizza a couple nights ago from Pequot's Pizza in Chicago. My daughter-in-law loves it. It's her favorite place, and she's always singing that song. And we were going to get pizza, and Brenda said, well, let's finally try Nikki's Pequot's Pizza. So I looked him up online, got the phone number. I don't like ordering through all of there's like 10 different services now that will deliver it to you. And I'm like, I don't know. But it turns out they do deliver. I don't know. They had a phone number. I called the phone number, and I said, do you deliver to my address? And she said, yes, we do. And I started ordering. She said, just so you know, delivery is right now 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny when, like, you're ordering a pizza at 7:30, and you're not thinking, well, I really want to eat it at 10 o'clock.
Right.
I want to eat it kind of close to 7:30. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, that's okay. I'll just swing by and pick it up. And she said, just so you know, it'll be an hour and a half before we can have a pizza ready for pickup.
Wow.
I don't know what that means. Maybe it's how good Pequot's is, or maybe it was an unusual night, or maybe it says something about restaurants having trouble getting delivery people and pizza cookers these days.
Well, a deep dish pizza is going to be a good 20 minutes in the oven.
I was going to order thin crust.
Oh, okay.
We never even got to that.
Wow.
I know. Maybe I should have led with that. Hey, but it'll be a thin crust.
Right. What can I have in 25 minutes?
I know.
Maybe it's just a salad and you put some chili flakes on it.
I've got some croutons and chili flakes. You're going to love them. I asked you last time you were in our studio to come up with a couple of places to go to before the warm weather goes, before it gets cold.
And we're having extraordinarily warm weather today.
Timing is great. So
this is so while you can do it.
Before it's too late, go to where?
Go to Cabra, Stephanie Izard's Spanish I mean, excuse me, Peruvian-influenced restaurant in the Hoxton Hotel on Lake Street at Green.
We'll post all of these on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John after Phil gives them. What else?
And ABBA, which is their rooftop, which is the Middle Eastern slash Mediterranean restaurant by the Let Us Entertain You people. And that's on Fulton Market, right at the corner of Fulton and Green. That's beautiful outdoors, and it's a scene, and you're going to want to be there. Another one that's fairly new is Pizzeria Portofino, opened this late spring, and is doing gangbusters business there at Clark in the River.
Yeah, if you want to go there while it's still warm, make reservations now, and they'll have a table for you next summer.
There's that. Or show up real early. Try to hit them in that odd 2:30. And then just grab that table and hang on like an outman platoon. You just hunker down.
You're going to have to keep ordering because you want to be there when the cool kids are there, and that's like 5 o'clock. I don't know how those people got there. They probably started at 2.
Right, at 2 o'clock you'll get to look at people like me. That's about it. And one of my all-time favorites is Piccolo Sogno. Tony Priolo's Italian restaurant. It's a gem at the convergence of Halsted and Milwaukee and Grand Avenue.
It's got an outdoor dining area.
It's got a beautiful outdoor restaurant, and he's got a big privacy fence around there. So once you get in there, it's landscaped, it's uplit. You would never believe that you're at one of the busiest intersections in Chicago at that moment. And it's one of those places where on a night like this, you walk in at 8 o'clock, and you can sit down indoors right away.
Right.
But outdoors, you might want to order a Pequot's pizza, which might get there before your table's ready.
Forget about it. All right, so the four we've mentioned were just now.
Just now, Cabra.
ABBA.
Pizzeria Portofino.
It's right on the river.
And Piccolo Sogno.
Okay, at the Six Corners intersection. By the way, what was the enterprise that just awarded finalist awards to three Chicago area restaurants? Do I see
Bon Appetit?
Bon Appetit. Where is that? Is this it here? No. Hold on. It's not this. Here it is. Three Chicago restaurants make Bon Appetit's Best New Restaurants nominee. The most surprising new nominee is probably Bungalow by Middlebrow on Armitage Avenue. Writes your colleague Nick Kindlesberger, the excellent brewery and pizzeria that our own Josh Noel gave 2 stars to. This is a brewery and pizzeria that Bon Appetit says is one of the best restaurants in America right now.
One of the best new ones.
These are new ones. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a pleasant surprise. The overall pleasant surprise is Chicago getting three restaurants on this list. It's more than we usually get.
You've talked about Korean-inspired places in town. Mm-hmm. And one of them they mention here is...
Jung.
J-U-N-G. Right. Jung. Mm-hmm.
J-E-O-N-G, I think.
Oh, you're right. J-E-O-N-G. And that's on West Chicago, 1460 West Chicago. Writes the Tribune, the ambitious Korean-inspired project by Dave Park and Jennifer Tran picked up 3 stars from Phil Vitale.
Wow. You know it's good then, huh?
He's right here. You really like that place.
I love that place.
What's so good about it?
The food is just excellent. They use traditional Korean ingredients, but they're very much... they grew up here. Dave Park is a Culinary Institute graduate, really knows his stuff. They had a restaurant out in Westmont briefly called Hanbun that had a cult following. And after that, then they moved into the city, and now it's just a pretty place. The food is just so consistently interesting and great technique and great ingredients.
Jung, and that's on Chicago Avenue in Chicago. And then I'll just conclude with this. Finally, it would have been a big deal if Kumiko and Kiko, Julia Momose's double restaurant concept of Japanese-inspired cocktails and small plates hadn't been included because it has seemingly picked up every new major honor available. Vitale gave it 3 stars. Food and Wine stuck it at number 5 on Best New Restaurants 2019, and Time magazine selected it as one of the world's 100 greatest places.
Wow.
What is that?
It's kind of an upstairs, downstairs setup. Kiko is downstairs, and it serves what you call an omakase menu, which is the chef-selected courses,
right,
and get a whole bunch of those for a set price. The fun thing they do is that Julia is a highly, highly, highly regarded mixologist and expert in sake and things of that nature. And so each course is paired with a specific cocktail or sake or even wine that she has selected. So you get a whole range of flavors and tastes and matches. It's a lot of fun. It costs a few bucks, but it's a lot of fun. Upstairs is Kumiko, and that is a small plates Japanese restaurant with interesting cocktails again. And the bar in front, you can sort of do a nice little mix and match because everything's, but there's only about 11 dishes available at all, and you just kind of do some of that. And if you're at the bar, Julia's usually back there, and she'll maybe
make one
of her cocktails or make something up on the spot that that you'll love.
This would be for Phil's Flash Fry. We got two more things to do. We'll take a break here and then come back with your latest review of Continent Hopping Flora Fauna. Still feeling its way, says Phil Vitale. We'll get to this latest restaurant. The food sounds good. It sounds over the top to me, but tell us more about this place. And then also Phil's Flash Fry, where you make a recommendation or ask Phil a question. What is it that you want to know? A place to eat? Some place you think he should try? Somebody said, John, I'm looking for a nice restaurant to dine at that's near the auditorium before the Nutcracker performance. What does he think about that? Phil, you can answer that in a couple of minutes. 312-981-7200. This is WGN.
I'm going to be right.
Speaking of food,
my vegetables, I'm going to chop down my vegetables.
Phil's Flash Fry, Phil Vitale, restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune, joins us on Wednesdays about this time.
My favorite.
And at the Phil's Flash Fry segment, we let you text in, call in. Hey, tell Phil you've got to try X. What is it? Where is it? Or can he help you somehow? Hey, Phil, valets at Sullivan's in downtown Naperville do not get to keep those tips.
Yeah.
What he said?
Yeah. I don't believe that is illegal.
Well,
if someone gives you a tip, it's your tip. Can't take tips back from...
It says here, valets at Sullivan's in downtown Naperville do not get to keep their tips.
Why would anyone work as a valet in a Naperville restaurant that wouldn't let you keep tips?
Hey, Phil, I'm looking for a nice restaurant to dine at that's near the auditorium before the Nutcracker performance. What do you suggest?
A couple. To the south, Mercat a la Plancha, Spanish tapas restaurant, very colorful, very good. 638 South Michigan Avenue, so you can stroll there. Opposite direction, go a little bit north to 24 South Michigan, and that's the Gauge, which is kind of a gastropub. Lots of beers, lots of sandwiches, and good burgers and things like that.
Good enough. What's the name of that place?
The Gauge.
The Gauge. Oh, yeah. A little pricey, but nice, huh?
Very nice. And then right next door to that is Acanto, which is their Italian, casual Italian restaurant. And a little bit further north, you can go to the Chicago Athletic Association Hotel, which is 12 South Michigan, and there you find the Cherry Circle Room,
which is beautiful.
Beautiful. Cherry wood circular dining room. It's really cool.
I like that room. It's especially in the winter and fall. I like that room, but it just
feels like there should be crackling fire, and you know, even when there isn't.
Hey, King John, I'm going to Portugal with Steve Bertrand in a couple of weeks. Steve does great trips. He's got a new one coming up to, where are you going, Steve?
Madrid, San Sebastian, Bordeaux, and Paris.
SteveBertrandTravel.com. Ask Phil if there are any good Portuguese restaurants in Chicago.
In Chicago, I'd get you halfway. I would send you over to Fat Rice, which is kind of Macanese food, which so it's coming from the island of Macau, but that's a real melting pot of Portuguese, Chinese, even some Indian food. Really interesting. A little more heat than you might expect to find at a strict Portuguese restaurant, but that should give you a little feel for the thing.
We're going to run out of time. Hey, Phil, we're entertaining West Coast friends who aren't afraid of beef and good cocktails. Any downtown suggestions?
Downtown place with beef?
And good cocktails.
Throw a rock and just walk into whatever it bounces off of. 3 million steakhouses, and they're all big on cocktails.
Do you like Chicago Cut?
I do like Chicago Cut. I like them. I like them quite a bit. And I like, well, the other ones, that's not as close. Chicago Cut. Michael Jordan's in the
I have not been there.
It is not bad at all. It's
really,
it's pretty solid. And the cocktails are
right on Michigan Avenue, just a block or so north of the river. How about this? A fun, unique, affordable date night spot in the Northwest Burbs. Somebody else said they're taking friends out in the northwest suburbs. Where would you like to go?
Big stretch of area.
I know, that could be Arlington Heights.
Schaumburg, Carpentersville, everything in between. It's in Arlington Heights. Anything in downtown Arlington Heights is probably going to be fun for you. They're just loaded with little restaurants down there. That's a great little place to go hanging around. That's a good date night thing. I stay away from the maybe the big bustling kind of 300 seaters that you find in the Schaumburg Woodfield Mall area,
like the Cheesecake Factories.
Yeah, I mean they're fine, but for a first date, I think I'd want something a little more intimate.
All right. Well, if you have another suggestion, I've got a pile now. It turns out we got more today than we normally get. I've got a load of them, and we don't have time for them all.
All right, send them to me as homework.
I will
give these to you,
and we will respond.
And I will
have
this prepared in duplicate for
next Wednesday.
Week.
We'll give you another chance. We'll start the flash fry sooner, but and we got to go now. 30 seconds on flora fauna.
Flora fauna, very interesting stuff. The cuisine is a combination of Central American and Caribbean and Mexican food, and with some Southeast Asian influences, which reflect the respective travels of the mixologist, Liz Pierce, and the chef, Jonathan Meyer, who are married, and they're just kind of doing a melding of all sorts of things. It's kind of pretty, and I had $1 million gift certificate at Pier 1 kind of way. Lots of rattan, lots of wicker, and it's a fun place, and Liz's cocktails are especially good.
Here's one of the sentences from your review. Taking over from the former Bohemian House space in River North, the interior affects a casual tropical vibe as though someone ran wild with the Pier 1 credit card. You make it sound shticky. You also say maybe they'll figure this out. You do give it 2 stars, but
yeah, the food's real good. I limit it because it's pretty bold stuff, and not everybody's going to get it, especially if you're spice phobic. But they've already had to change it. They started off by doing their big dishes, calling them hot pots, big bowls, and lots of stuff, and they had to change it because it was confusing people who were thinking this was going to be strictly an Asian hot pot, and it wasn't.
It's new. It's Flora Fauna, 11 West Illinois Street.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. 2 stars today from the review by Phil Vitale. Conversation challenged, as so many of them are. Mm-hmm. Nice to see you, Phil. We'll do more of the Flash Fry next week. Thanks for coming
in. I'll do it. Sure.
You can read them online, chicagotribune.com/dining.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
It's a living.
Here's John Williams.
We are in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago, on a warm and humid day. Hooray, said a man who likes summer days like this.
Lord have mercy.
But wear sunscreen. On Saturdays, we're on from 10 to 3. Don't miss our award-winning podcast, The Mincing Rascals. Wherever you hear podcasts, just search for The Mincing Rascals. You can tell Spotify or your smart speaker, play The Mincing Rascals podcast, and you will hear it there. One of the people on that podcast is our friend Eric Zorn. And he, along with Mary Schmeek, are two of my favorite columnists in a city of great columnists. Mary Schmeek is in our studio. Mary, nice to see you. It's been a while. How have you been?
Good to see you, John. I'm fine. I'm hot and I'm sweaty, and that to me is bliss.
You love this kind of weather.
I do. Georgia girl.
So let's just jump into this. I'm trying to figure out why I have in my stream, in my feed, a bunch of stuff about your Wear Sunscreen graduation speech that you wrote 22 years ago, right?
Correct, in 1997.
20 years ago, that speech you wrote, which is really just a column, but a speech, 20 years ago, that column became the number one song in the UK. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you didn't sing it, but a guy named Boz Luhrmann, who's from Australia.
A movie maker.
Who also made Romeo and Juliet.
Right, and Moulin Rouge.
So somehow or another, he finds out about the column and then decides to turn it into a song.
Song in quote. It was a spoken word piece.
And you didn't really have anything to do with that. I mean, it's not like you picked out the music or co-produced it.
No, but I was very aware that they were doing this, and I was in contact with them the whole time that they were doing it.
So then that all happens 22 and 20 years ago. And it's sort of resonated through the decades now since. It's been appropriated. It's been stolen. People thought that Kurt Vonnegut did it. That's another sort of sidebar to this whole story, isn't it?
That's the origin story of this.
Why do you call it the origin story? Vonnegut didn't write it.
No, but do you really want me to get into that whole long story right now?
Let's start first with, okay, so here we are now on the 20-year anniversary of this thing being the number one song in the UK. And so the BBC has done an hour-long documentary podcast about this whole thing, right?
Right. So this BBC Radio 2 documentary, an hour long, on the Sunscreen song, was broadcast in England on Sunday night. Okay. So that's why you're getting it in your feed, because this is a new radio documentary that goes through the whole story of how my column was turned into a song, which became the number one hit in England in 1999, and they follow it through and talk not just about what happened, but how this piece resonated for those young people who were so attached to it at that age. And they go back and they find some of them who are now middle-aged, John, and imagining that they're old, and just talking to them about what it meant to them
and
20 years ago.
What it meant to them, right? And still means to people today. It's great radio craft that they put to a column that deserves it. We won't play the whole hour-long doc here, of course, but I'll give you the first 2 minutes. This is how they start it.
Don't worry about the future, or worry, but know that worrying is as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubblegum.
I do think that voice of God, voice, is the voice that if you were driving around in your car and this thing came on the radio, that voice would be the voice that's going to make you pull over just to listen.
Don't be reckless with other people's hearts. Don't put up with people who are reckless with yours.
You know, it's a kind voice to listen to, but it also has a gravitas to it. My name's Caroline Faraday. I'm a TV and radio broadcaster. I, at that time, worked for a radio station in London called Capital FM. And when we would do request shows, unfailingly, this was the song that people requested. You got that Sunscreen song? Can you play that Sunscreen song? So there were loads of great songs that we used to play, but there was nothing that sounded like that.
Don't feel guilty if you don't know what you want to do with your life. The most interesting people I know.
Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen topped the UK charts in the summer of 1999. If you remember that year, you must remember the song. You couldn't miss it.
Be kind to your needs. You'll miss them when they're gone.
Baz Luhrmann, the Aussie film director famous for his movie version of Romeo and Juliet, had taken a piece from the film's soundtrack and laid a spoken word recording over the top of it. A passage which had become an early internet viral hit. A wise voice offering advice to the young. How did this unconventional track become a hit? Not just in Britain, but pretty much everywhere. And were the class of 99 listening?
If I could offer you only one tip for the future, sunscreen would be it.
What a terrific open. Now you want to hear that story, don't you? Aren't you happy for this, or are you tired of this?
You know, I am always fascinated, mystified, gratified by the long life that this is having. I do love having this documentary out there because even though I know most of the story myself, this is the best rendition of the whole thing and how it happened. And I love it. And I love hearing all of these voices. I mean, just the sound of this documentary I find beautiful.
Fair enough. 815 says, oh my God, I didn't realize Mary wrote that. I absolutely love it. Isn't it funny that you've owned this thing for 22 years?
And I still get, you know, people tweet at me almost every day. They email me almost every day, often, either to say, I remember this from when I was 15, when I was 21, graduating from high school or college. And I just wanted to tell you what it's meant to me through those years, or how I didn't understand it then, and now I do understand
it. Yeah.
Or people, you know, like this person who says, oh my God, I never had any idea. I thought Baz Luhrmann wrote it, or I thought Kurt Vonnegut wrote it.
224 just texted in, holy cow, John, this spoken word song has meant so much to me for years. It still brings me to tears. Thank you, Mary. I'm so thrilled at this Chicago connection.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chicago.
Thank them. Yay, Chicago. Go Chicago.
Chicago origin. It's not a Chicago connection. It started here. So tell me about the day you wrote the piece.
So, you know, I write a regular column at the Tribune, have for many, many years. It was a Friday. I was walking to work along Lake Michigan. I didn't have anything to write about. I was in a near panic, and I saw a young woman sunbathing, and I thought, oh, my God, I hope she's wearing sunscreen, because I didn't at that age, and the mirror reminds me of that all the time. And I was just laughing at myself. I thought, you know, I've reached this age in life where I just want to give advice to young people. And then as I walked along with my deadline nearing, I thought, well, I could write a mock graduation speech as my column. And I could just toss in whatever little ideas I have about life into my mock graduation speech. So I went to Tribune Tower, and got some M&Ms and a cappuccino. And high on caffeine and sugar, I spent a very pleasant afternoon just writing down some things that came to my mind, trying to order them in a way that it wasn't totally randomly ordered, right? I mean, it was written, trying to order them in a way that seemed to make sense.
These things don't happen by accident, people.
You know, I finished around 6 o'clock, and I thought, you know, I kind of like this. I don't think that after every column.
I wondered about that. When you wrote that, did you think I just wrote something for the ages?
No, of course not. Of course not. When you write three times a week, you never think you've written anything for the ages. You're just lucky to have met another deadline. But I did think, oh, this feels right to me. And then it appeared in the paper in print that Sunday. I can't even remember if we had a website. And I thought, and I got some nice snail mail about it. And I thought that was the end of that.
Then what happened?
A couple months later, you have to remember, 1997, even email was new, right? The internet was new. So this was all very mysterious to people. And I got up on another Friday morning, and I had a flood of email from people saying, you know, I just got this weird email from my cousin, my brother, my friend in Denver, in L.A., you know, wherever, saying that this was Kurt Vonnegut's graduation address to MIT.
That happened that quickly?
Yes, yes. So it happened in August. This was a Friday in August. My column appeared on June 1st, 1997. So 2 months after it appeared in print, it started going around the world on email.
You were viral before there was viral.
I was viral before there was viral. And the word viral was not even...
And that
a
quickly
thing.
It became attributed to Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes.
Now, who did that?
No one has ever figured that out. Who knows?
And did you care? I mean, because somebody knew that it wasn't Kurt Vonnegut, and they attributed it to him.
Right. I mean, was it a deliberate hoax, or did somebody just, like, type it into an email and not attribute it, and then somebody decided it sounded
like
Kurt Vonnegut? Who knows? That has never been deduced. That is the mystery that will never be solved.
So what did you start to think is, because in the doc, they said you were worried that somebody was going to accuse you of plagiarism.
Yeah, so on that Friday morning in August, 2 months after I wrote the column, and all these people are writing to say, I don't get this. I remember reading this in your column.
Yeah, I thought you wrote this.
And I laughed out loud at first. I thought, this is hilarious. I didn't understand. And then I got an email from a guy, Hank DeSutter, a journalist, and he said, this looks very bad. This looks like you plagiarized Kurt Vonnegut. He wasn't accusing me of it, but he said, you know, you need to get on top of this. And then I panicked. And, you know, you hear people who did plagiarize say that they went into a black hole and they didn't know they did it. And so for, you know, like just a nanosecond, I thought, oh, my God, did I go into that black hole? Did I steal this? And so I started trying to find Kurt Vonnegut. It took me many, 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 many emails and phone calls. I finally got a phone number for him in the Hamptons. I called him up. Of course, I'm scared to death. I'm calling up Kurt Vonnegut.
You're
right?
Mary Schmeek, but Kurt Vonnegut picks up. Pick up the story here in a minute. Mary Schmeek, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Chicago Tribune and the woman who inadvertently authored an international musical hit. 20 years ago, it was number one on the BBC in the UK, and the BBC just dropped a documentary about her column, Wear Sunscreen, and the song that it became via that filmmaker named Baz Luhrmann. There's a lot to unpack there. You've been telling us the story about how you wrote this as a graduation speech, a column, but what if I were giving a speech? And the people immediately attributed it to Kurt Vonnegut. So you tracked down Kurt Vonnegut, right?
Well, so it went around the new internet. It was one of the first viral things. It went around the internet attributed to Kurt Vonnegut instead of to me. So when it became clear that people were thinking that I stole this from Kurt Vonnegut, or that maybe he stole it from me, but mostly that I stole it from him, because isn't that how it would work? I decided I had to find Kurt Vonnegut. So I tracked him down. I got his phone number in the Hamptons. I called. I was so nervous because, I mean, I'm calling the legendary Kurt Vonnegut. He picks up, and I say, hi, Mr. Vonnegut. My name is Mary Schmeek, and I write for the Chicago Tribune, and I wrote this thing, Wear Sunscreen, and he just started laughing. And he said, oh, my God, it's you. And he said, all of these people have been calling him. They, you know, they wanted to turn it into a song. They wanted to reprint it. His wife had emailed him and said, honey, why didn't you tell me that you gave the graduation address at MIT? So
MIT, yes. So the rumor was that Vonnegut gave this address at MIT.
Right. He didn't even give any address at MIT, right? Much less this one.
So you just at least settled that point.
Right. So I wrote a column just, you know, clarifying for my editors, if no one else, that, you know, yes, I wrote this. Kurt Vonnegut did not write this. And again, I thought that was that. At every point in this that I thought, well, that was that,
it turned out that
was going to be something else. So shortly after I wrote the column about Kurt, I get a voicemail on my Tribune phone saying, hi, Mary, this is Baz Luhrmann. I'm a movie maker in Australia, and I have an idea for the material. He explains that his assistant, Anton, had brought him this piece and that he had, quote, an idea for the material, a very movie maker phrase. And I thought, is this a joke? What does that even mean? An idea for the material? It's a newspaper column. So he had this idea. He wanted to make a spoken word piece in which he would lay the words of the column over some of the music that he had used in his movie, William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. So that's what he did. It became, I mean, it was 7 minutes long. There's no way it was going to get any radio airplay, right? But somehow he managed to get it on the radio in Australia. So it quickly became a big hit in Australia. And I thought, well, that's that. And then, like a year goes by, or sometimes, some months at least go by, and a radio station in Santa Monica, California, started playing the full 7-minute version. Great, cool. It's playing in Santa Monica. Then a radio station in Portland, Oregon heard it, cut it down to just the words. They took all the interstitiary music out of it so that it became no longer 7 minutes, but 5 minutes.
Better for
that,
radio.
That play is almost viable on the radio. And it became this cult hit in Portland, Oregon. Groovy. That's that. And then the New York Times Magazine did a little blurb one Sunday talking about this cult hit in Portland, Oregon. And the whole thing exploded. Every DJ in the country started playing it. It just took off. People
about
started,
what year are we talking here?
That would have been early 1999, I think.
And is the version that I'm familiar with the 5-minute version that was edited in Oregon?
Yes, that's the 5-minute version.
So there's a longer dance version, if you will.
Well, there's several versions of it, right? Yeah. But once it became a hit in the United States, Baz Luhrmann turned it into a single. It had been on an album. Turned it into a single, and it was the single that, as we now say, dropped in the UK.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. And then the UK picked this thing up.
Yeah, and then it became number one in the UK in 1999.
And people in England remember it as fondly as we do in the United States, but that gets it to there, and that's why 20 years later, the BBC 3 days ago dropped this documentary podcast about the story that you're telling us, your right. column and the life that it had. Hey, John, I just heard the same thing about Vonnegut. This is an amazing story. This is a great feel-good story. 847 says, John and Mary, my mom made a copy of Mary's column from the newspaper. She gave it to me after it ran. I still have it. I'm 49.
Oh,
loved
God,
it.
God bless your mom.
Okay, so
can I make just one thing? We've left out here the narrator of this. So the voice that we've been hearing is a guy named Lee Perry, who is a voiceover actor in Australia. And that's who Baz picked to voice this, because he still, you know, it started out with this idea that Kurt Vonnegut had given this speech. And so they were aiming for that wise, older man.
They're going to have that on your tombstone, you know. Here lies Mary Schmeek. It's not Kurt Vonnegut. Mary, I'm out of time. On my Facebook page, on social media, I'm WGN King John. We'll post a link to the column. I must say the favorite line in the column for me, and you probably get this all the time, is be kind to your knees.
Do you miss them now that they're gone, John?
I miss them now that they're gone. Why did I decide to be running marathons would be a good idea? Be kind to your knees. And the advice in this resonates to this day still. The only thing I think that doesn't travel that well is about balancing your checkbook.
It's keeping your old bank statements.
Yes.
I know, because who has bank statements anymore? Keep your old love letters, too. And I don't think people have love letters anymore.
Okay, so we'll feature a little of the song after the news. One other announcement about something Mary Schmeek and I may be doing on stage.
Don't worry about the future, or worry, but know that worrying is as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubble gum. The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind, the kind that blindsides you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday. Do one thing every day that scares you. Sing. Don't be reckless with other people's hearts. Don't put up with people who are reckless with yours. Floss. Don't waste your time on jealousy. Sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind. The race is long, and in the end,
Bob Lerman's reading of Mary Schmeek's column.
No, it's actually Lee Perry.
Lee Perry is reading. Yeah. And Bob Lerman's producing.
Bob Lerman's producing.
Of Mary Schmeek's column, which a couple of decades ago was a global sensation. And a few days ago, the BBC did a podcast, an hour-long documentary.
Yeah, can I make a...
About the phenomenon.
A remark that just hit me as that was playing. You know, there's a line in there that says the real troubles in your life are apt to be the kind that will blindside you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday. And after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, which was on a Tuesday, many people wrote me to say, wow, that's this kind of, it wasn't 4 p.m., but this kind of weird foreshadowing, right? The real troubles in your life will be the ones that blindside you on some idle Tuesday.
Hadn't thought about it that way, Mary. The thing has resonance, doesn't it? And not just for that, but just for the sort of boilerplate, if you will, advice that it gives out, which 20 years later is still good advice, too. I mean, floss. I wish I had heeded that. Pardon me from jumping from 9/11 to floss, but it all makes great life sense, doesn't it?
It's the basics, John.
Yeah. So that was the column you wrote. Some people thought Kurt Vonnegut did it. He didn't. You reached out to him. You told us a moment ago. And he said, oh, there you are. Anything else that we need to tell about the sort of evolution of this story to where we are today? Is that where it ends? I was wondering if you would ever do a sequel. Have people approached you? Have you thought, here's the next one?
No, I had publishers approach me wanting me to do a sequel. I had a very, very big publisher come to me and want me to write a children's book version of it. But I always resisted commercializing it in any way or trying to follow it up in any way, right? And I didn't think that Baz Luhrmann's Lee Perry's version of it was commercializing it. It was taking it and making the original thing, conveying it in a different way. But that wasn't the same as trying to cash in on becoming some advice guru, which I have never wanted to be and would not be a good person to follow.
312 texted in and said, John, I lived by Mary's advice in wear sunscreen through the 90s, including living on the West Coast once and leaving before I got soft.
Good for you.
Living on the East Coast once and leaving before I
got hard.
Turned hard. I have started many, many music mixes over the years with the song version. It is iconic to me. Isn't it nice that you sort of provided that to people in their lives through so many years?
I have to say it is one of the most gratifying and mystifying things that has ever happened to me.
Okay, so that BBC podcast is out there, and I think I put it up on my Facebook page, but we're also posting the original column. I mean, all of this predicated on something Mary wrote in 1997 and in June of 97.
Old-fashioned newsprint.
Well, there it is. Elif, do we have it up on my Facebook page now, the original column? She's nodding yes. So click on it there. It'll take you to the Trib site and Mary Schmeek's piece. You and Eric Zorn do Songs of Good Cheer with the folks from the Old Town School of Folk Music, or the Old Town School of Folk Music does Songs of Good Cheer with you and Eric Zorn.
We all do it together.
You do. And it's a highlight of the season for my family. And tickets.
It's a holiday sing-along.
It is. And it's songs you know and some you don't. Performed so well by the musicians on stage, you and them. And you guys give us songbooks and we sing along. It's just a good old-fashioned sing-along.
It is. And it's a lot of people come and think, oh, my God, it's going to be so corny. Somebody dragged them there, right? And I can't tell you how many people come up to me afterwards or written me afterwards and said, I really wasn't looking forward to this hootenanny, but I loved it.
You walk in and you see all the red and green sweaters and you go, just really? And then it's wonderful.
The music is first rate. The musicians are fantastic.
And the music's surprising, too, because you will do Silent Night or, I don't know, some standards, but it's not really built around those. It's
enough of the standards so that you don't have to work, but it introduces you to some things that once you've sung them, you feel like you've known your whole life.
Well, a traditional song in my family, one that Brenda and I so look forward to every year, is the one that you wrote and that you all perform every year. I presume you'll do it again this year?
We do it every year.
Hooray for that. Now, you may have gotten an email. The tickets just went on sale or are going on sale this week. Is that right?
Tickets are on sale today for members of the Old Town School of Folk Music, and they will be on sale Friday for the general public.
Okay, so you heard it here first. If you didn't already know, if you want to do Songs of Good Cheer again this year, you got to get on those tickets right now. Go to wherever you buy tickets, Old Town School of Folk Music's website.
They do tend to sell out pretty fast.
They do, and for good reason. And there's like half a dozen shows, right?
Yeah, we're up to 6 shows now.
She said with kind of a funny face. It's my hope, and I know it's our hope at this radio station, that we will be able to broadcast one of those performances this year here on WGN. I don't know that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed on that, so maybe that won't happen, but we're working on doing that. Meantime, get your tickets to Eric and Mary and the Old Town Schools show. All right, Ms. Schmeek, thank you for coming in.
John, it's always so nice to talk to you and talk to your listeners.
Oh, and one last thing. At the end of that BBC doc, that podcast, they wisely did something that I'd never heard before, and that is you reading that column to the music.
That was fun, wasn't it?
I hope that was fun for you. You did really well.
Yeah, I actually didn't. What they did, they had me read it. I had recorded this in a studio here in Chicago. They had me read the whole thing, but not over the music. They just had me read it.
They mixed it down.
And then Baz, I guess, sent them the music, and they had Lee Perry doing the beginning and the end of it, but then they put my voice over the music, so it made me feel professional.
Mary Schmeek's Wear Sunscreen column. 20 years ago, number one in the UK, and the BBC, for that reason, puts that out 3 days ago. You'll hear more about that.
Love is a verb. Love is a doing word. Fearless.
The musical hour today. What are you playing, Ellen?
Massive Attack.
I knew that. I was going to guess Massive Attack.
You might recognize this song from several 90s shows and movies. One of them was Angel, and I just tried to look up a few others, and I didn't have time, but Massive Attack is playing at the Chicago Theater tonight. They're on their Mezzanine 11 tour, which is an album that they released in 1998, I believe. So they're doing like a return tour.
Is this what they sound like usually?
Yeah.
Pretty typical. Mm-hmm. This does sort of have soundtrack to 90s romantic drama,
right,
or something like
and
that.
And in that BBC podcast of Mary Schmeek's Wear Sunscreen column, they mentioned this era of ambient sounding music, and I was recording this song while you were listening to that.
This has Felicity written all over it, or something like that. Nice to know. 2:55 on WGN Radio. Hey, did you get tickets yet? Speaking of selling tickets to Songs of Good Cheer, I hope you're planning on joining us for our Teddy Roosevelt show. It's going to be October 12th at 10:30, Elgin Community College's Blizzard Theater. There's nothing else like this anywhere. It's a real pat on the back, not to me, but to the guy that does our Teddy Roosevelt. I don't know if you're into that or him, but I promise you, if you just invest an hour and a half of your September 12th, October 12th with us, you're going to be very glad that you did. It's funny. It's learned. You'll have a better sense of America and what this president was like and what the presidency can be. I ask questions. You ask questions. You've been to these shows before. A lot of you come again and again because every time it's different. It's a spontaneous, unrehearsed conversation we have on stage with TR. Get your tickets at WGNradio.com/Teddy. WGNradio.com/Teddy or call this number, 847-622-0300, Elgin Community College's Blizzard Theater. It's sponsored by our friends at the Joint Relief Institute. It's also 2:56, so let's pause here. We'll get ready to head into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. The stories that matter are coming your way. Rowan, Anna are too. That's all next.
Ah! Did it.
Did it.
Hello, Rokan.
You nailed it.
Nailed it.
Nicely done, John.
Thank you. It's a gift.
Hey, I read some excerpts of that book, and I enjoyed your interview. Can I throw out one other thing that's out there? What Happened on September 11th is an HBO series that tells the stories of September 11th to children, when you think about an entire generation of school children now, up to 18 years old or even beyond that, who look at this as history and want to understand what happened.
History.
The impact.
Yeah, all the more reason to tell those stories.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, no kidding. What are you guys doing today?
We've got, that Ben Bradley. He stops by every day whether we want him to or not. Brett Baer from the Fox News Channel will be here. We'll talk a little bit about 9/11. And also, Donald Trump was detailing the firings of John Bolton.
Right.
Firings.
Yeah. Firing of John Bolton. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then the president had an unfortunate moment today, too, when he was talking about the vaping thing and how it's impacting kids and teens, and everybody's got to, get together on this. Parents have to get together, even Melania's son, and he referred to, her son as opposed to, our son.
He referred to Barron as yes. Melania's son?
Yes. Hmm. Yes. It's my wife's son. I think it's my wife's son. He doesn't like...
The words that come out of that man's mouth.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? And I'm just trying to think. All right, now before I get super critical, I'm thinking, have I ever done that? I probably have done something similar. I think, maybe. Because, as a parent, right? As parents, mm-hmm. We're all parents here, that, you're supposed to say our child.
True.
Right? Well, Not my child.
The only time I do something like that is when my kids do something bad or
right.
crazy.
Then it's on somebody else.
I go, boy, that's your kid, Brenda. But I see that coming. That never happens by accident.
Right?
I mean, come on. Mostly I like these kids. I never forget that they're my own.
I don't know. Oh, man. He's got a lot on his mind. Let's just go with that. And then Mike Rogers is going to be here a little bit later on. He's the guy from former the House Intel Committee chairman. And now you see him on CNN. He's got a show on CNN. called Declassified, which is really cool. But he's like he's a badass. He used to run the FBI. He was second in command of the FBI office here in Chicago for a while.
Wow.
In his career. Right.
All right. I'm out of your way.
Thank you very much.
Have a good one.